This podcast is brought to you by the Albany Public Library Main Branch and the generosity of listeners like you.
What is a podcast?
God, Daddy, these people talk as much as you do. Razib Khan's Unsupervised Learning.
Hello, everybody. This is Razib Khan with the Unsupervised Learning podcast. This week, I am recording a podcast with Brian Chow, a returning guest, entrepreneur, technologist, cultural critic in various ways. And he has a new project related to the intersection of technology and media, using some of the technological tools that we have today to try to break, to basically do investigative journalism, but do it a quantitative and rigorous way. I think it's pretty interesting. And I actually have wondered who was going to do this because, what you're doing, Brian, is, it's interesting. It's novel, but it also seems like it was going to be inevitable. And so I was wondering, and I guess that was you who was going to do it. So talk to me about your new project. Actually, you talk about your background, whatever that matters to people, but then talk to you about your new project because that's really why you're here.
Yeah. I mean, most people, the things that they look at and stand out is I did IOI Gold in 2017, this big programming contest. I started Alliance for the Future, which was this NGO in DC that was actually advocating for, pro AI policies, not one of the anti AI ones. I just left my old software position at Network School. But the project is a lot more interesting. So the project, I saw a lot of people trying to do investigative journalism by having AI automate the writing. And it's shocking to me that AI writing still sucks. The best people in the world have been working on it. They've cracked the hard math problems. They've cracked coding. But the writing is still terrible. But instead of doing that, we use AI to query these massive troves of documents. So in some cases, literally millions of documents, financial records, legal records, filings, stuff like that. And we use that to break stories, and we have broken stories, and there'll be a lot more on the way.
Yeah. So talk about the, I think the high level people understand how this is going to work in terms of, technology, software, algorithms, programs, whatever you want to call it, they're good at munging through big piles of data. Talk about the logistics of what you had to do, because I'm assuming someone can't just go onto research grade ChatGPT and just do everything you did, do this, do some command prompt or whatever. What are the nuts and bolts here?
Yeah, the main thing that we found is that the LLMs are very inefficient. When they're making queries to government databases, things like that, they'll just run out of usage incredibly quickly. And maybe if you're willing to pay, tens of thousands of dollars, then that's probably feasible, actually. But a lot of what we ended up doing was optimizations around, creating offline copies of the database, streamlining those queries, optimizing those tool calls in some other ways. A lot of that is the infra stuff. And then there's also the sort of judgment component where it does help a lot to have an idea of where to point the LLMs. For example, for the ORRPC story, the Office of Refugee Resettlement Preferred Communities Grant. This was the widest story, had thousands of likes on Twitter. This one, we kind of got it, it kind of came about by querying the HHS grant table. So something like that, where we have a defined data source and we kind of know at least where we're looking, if not what we're looking for. This one, we didn't know what we were looking for. It was literally just, identify grants that spiked during this period, during the most recent 6 years under the HHS grant table. When we have a unified data source, that becomes much easier. So it's both the human judgment around how to use it and some of the more technical optimizations around how the LLMs are fetching data.
Okay. And so, didn't do the research on your particular project right now. Is it, are you trying
it's actually it's really interesting that a lot of people have thought that this era was coming for a long time. And it was like, you talked about it as inevitable, but people have said that for a while, where even under Nixon, there was this whole era of sunlight is the best disinfectant. It's time for transparency and so on. And people thought, oh, if we make these laws mandating that governments will have to make certain disclosures, then that'll usher in a whole wave of truth and reconciliation. You know, people will now know the truth. People will now know what's going on with their government. And that never really materialized. People thought it was going to materialize. People also thought it was going to materialize in the 2010s. I'm sure there's been more historical cycles where that's happened. But it didn't really materialize until now. And I think that's the thing that we're fixing, is that we now have the raw data sources. We've had the raw data sources for a long time, but for the first time, it's becoming feasible to actually do this kind of investigation.
Okay, so I guess one thing I was going to ask is, you know, is this going to be, is this a startup? Is this for profit? Like, do you have a moat?
Yeah, it's a startup. It's for profit. We are already making money. The monetization is super fascinating around this. I think that we're kind of in an era, it sort of reminds me of like PayPal or where like people don't really know how to monetize this stuff. So right now we have subscribers, but there's a lot more we could do. One interesting thing was SemiAnalysis recent raise. They raised at, I think, a $200 million valuation. And
actually,
things, of course.
Really quick, tell them what SemiAnalysis is. I mean, we know what it is, but not everyone.
Yeah, it's a trade publication for you know, the semiconductor industry. And a big way they make money is by doing these like business intelligence reports for specific companies. And you kind of see where I'm going with this, right? With the technology that's available to us, it's actually not too different to query private sources of data as opposed to public sources of data. There's nothing in our pipeline that says like, we can only fetch from, you know, public sources. So I think that as we establish, and I think that this also matters a lot to our positioning, as we establish ourselves as the highest grade standard of published information. And I've thought a lot about that as regards to sourcing, as it comes to the aesthetics of the site, as it comes to what stories we'll cover and what sources we'll use. As we establish ourselves as the highest, essentially like highest quality, highest refinement of information, that becomes something you want for your own organization. And so that becomes a path towards revenue that I think is really viable. And there's a lot of other adjacent techniques around that. So one other thing I was thinking about is like a newswire. This is something that would just be like super awesome from like a visual standpoint, where we could literally publish a story and we can see the chart of like, oh, here's the tick that went up after we published the story. This is kind of what Bloomberg already does. And something that could be even more interesting is that many startups from like Series A or Series B onwards spend a lot of time doing audit preparation, right? Or diligence preparation, essentially gathering all of the internal financials, all of the data that otherwise might have been messy from multiple data sources and kind of joining them in order to create baseline financials that they present to investors or you know, in the case of public companies, they have to file and, you know, this is actually under, you know, under the threat of law. And I've been in these experiences before, and I would estimate that it costs, you know, millions, if not tens of millions of dollars, even for a medium-sized startup. And for a public company, it could easily cost up to, you know, billions of dollars. So I think the market for this kind of technology, it's really unclear at the moment what the best way to monetize it is. I think at the end stage, we'll have a kind of, we'll kind of have a throw everything at the wall strategy in terms of monetization, but there's a ton there. And yeah, the whole thing is for profit. Right now we don't have any investors, but I would expect that to change pretty soon.
Right. So you're bootstrapping it.
Yeah, we're bootstrapping it. The burn is really low, especially with, it's interesting because I've kind of drifted around. I've not had a lot of jobs where I can combine the media stuff with technical or just kind of like programming background. But it's interesting, I'm able to kind of switch between the technical optimization and kind of harness building and the kind of more human judgment side of these things in this company really often, which is something that's super fun.
So let's talk about like what are the biggest things you have discovered right now in terms of what have you uncovered just in the short. You've been around for what, like a week?
Yeah, so we've been out for a week. The launch was last Monday, and the company has been around for around a month. The biggest story, I actually discovered this story while I was doing just random experiments. I was actually building, to speak to the audit point, I was building the audit software.
Real quick, I should interrupt. Probably we should just say it's effort.news, right? Effort.news.
Yeah, effort.news is where you find all the stories. Yeah. Effort.news/PC is the biggest one. This These asylum grants, these migration and refugee services grants that have gone to some of the biggest critics of the Trump policy. I don't know if you followed this story, but you know, every time there's like a Trump migration policy story, they will bring out these like religious NGOs that claim to represent Christian Americans. And as we found, like 81.8% of their revenue in one case, USCCB, comes from these migration contractors. It's like, you know, you're bringing out the bakery to comment on how, you know, every American should buy bread, how it's a federal right to subsidize bread, how it's a moral good to you know, bake bread. That's what is happening with bringing out these organizations that are, you know, the vast majority of their funding comes from migration and refugee services grants, yet they're presented by the media as like neutral arbiters or as like somehow morally representative of Christians in America. And it's this kind of crazy conflict of interest that was completely undisclosed for, you know, decades. And we actually found this story. This was the story that I found by querying the HHS grant table. It was actually like a lot fairer than how a lot of investigative journalism comes about. Because a lot of journalism, you know, even going back to Nixon, it's like a source comes to you with a story that they want you to publish. And sometimes that's newsworthy. I'm not saying it's never right to publish in that case. But that's following someone's agenda. In this case, we literally queried, you know, find newsworthy findings in the HHS grant table from 2020 to 2026. Look in particular for massive spikes in grant funding. And this was a program that went from around 90 million, not a lot, maybe a lot to you know, you and I, but nothing compared to the 1.2 billion that it rose to under Biden. And so it was this like massive.
Wait, so that's a 10x.
More than 10x. It's more than 10x. 90 to 1.2 billion, 90 million to 1.2 billion. And we found this by just querying the HHS grant table for anomalies.
So how many how big is the data that you're querying? Just like, again.
Yeah, I think it's some number of hundreds of thousands of rows.
Okay. And so, I mean, you know, the old school days back before even computers, like there were investigative journalists, but obviously these sorts of things were not possible before you had automation and computation to actually like look through the patterns, right?
Oh, absolutely. When we launched, a lot of people compared us to ProPublica. And that's a super interesting comparison because ProPublica has, you know, teams of, you know, 10, 20 journalists report on stories for like four or so years.
Tell the listener what ProPublica is real quick.
Yeah, they do a lot of tax stuff. They investigate essentially like tax documents and filings, right? They're this kind of somewhat left of center NGO. It's a nonprofit. And they do a lot of investigations into like, for example, like what the Koch funding network is donating to, right? And they've done this for a lot of like NGO networks. And they basically go and they read all of the tax filings from all of these organizations. And then they kind of manually input those numbers into some kind of spreadsheet or some kind of graphic. And, you know, it's this very labor intensive work. And they will have to have, you know, large teams of lawyers and journalists and researchers do this for many years on end. Their investigations don't come out in a week. They don't come out in even 3 weeks. They come out, it takes a matter of years. So I think the scope and the quantity of what's possible is totally different now.
And so, I mean, in terms of totally different, like you say, like 10x, 100x, like basically is your rate limiter at this point just the resources you put? Because that's what it sounded like. Like in terms of like token, I mean, whatever, like, you know, it could be tokens, it could be GPUs, whatever. But I mean, are you limited basically by your spend, by your infrastructure at this point?
I think we're limited in a few ways. We're not limited by infra at all at the moment. We're limited in part by writing, actually. The AI writing is pretty bad, and we're onboarding more writers as we speak onto the team. I'm hiring. If you are someone who's interested in joining, jobs@effort.news is where to send us an email. But we're onboarding more hiring, and we're trying to figure out more ways to expand the search and to identify what's newsworthy. I think that the LLMs are pretty good at identifying clear quantitative changes. Things like the ORPC program, which was, you know, went from 90 million to 1.2 billion. That's like objectively newsworthy. Although, you know, it kind of evaded coverage for like 5 years. What's more, I think like either getting those tips, right? Getting those areas where it's like, oh, this is something to investigate. This is something that's very important. This is something that will actually see a lot of attention, right? That people will want to hear about. That's one key skill, maybe the most important skill. And another part of that skill is communicating it to LLM. So figuring out, you know, at a harness level, how to expand the kind of qualitative search that we're capable of doing. And I think we're improving at that every day. But there's still a lot more to get better on that.
Yeah, real quick, explain what a harness is again. This is a term that's like coming up a lot, but in the AI space. But a lot of the normies don't know this. You're talking about what a harness is.
Yeah, for sure. I really appreciate these questions. So a harness is essentially a system that organizes LLM output, right? So take, you know, Claude Code or Codex or OpenClaw. You guys might have heard of those. It's like very often, although not always, it's a system that runs in your terminal, right? That's uses some kind of file system, and it can take things from the LLMs and, you know, write them to a file, or it can, you know, read from your files and send that output to LLMs, or it can put together a lot of other tools like, you know, using a Google search or, you know, running a Python script, running a JavaScript script. It's essentially a way to kind of glue together multiple pieces of traditional software in a way that the AI models can use. And they've been something that's been responsible for creating a massive amount of revenue for OpenAI, for Anthropic, and for a lot of other companies.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, some people thought that, you know, we would just have, when we had LLMs, basically, you know, you do command prompts and, you know, let's just go. But it turns out that there's a lot of layers of analysis, a lot of layers of technological work between the LLM and the output that's human digestible or human comprehensible at this point. Let's talk about like what's on deck. Like, what are you thinking about?
We are working on a big story right now that's going to be 10 times larger than the 1.2 billion refugee grant program, and that's going to be a $20 billion. Essentially like system, an entire ecosystem funded by Medicaid to essentially do wealth transfers to reduce racial disparity. So it's this entire program using Medicaid, this $21 billion program that is essentially transferring money or incentivizing the transfer of money from essentially, you know, whites and Asians towards blacks and Hispanics. That is practically the effect of this outcome, and we're graphing all of that as well. And this is something that we'll be breaking, I think, by the time this episode is out.
Okay. And so, I mean, in terms of the growth prospects for this sort of like technology, like, do you think like, obviously you're out there, you're doing it. You're bootstrapping. Do you think you're going to have imitators? Like, how are you feeling in terms of just like the business landscape? Like, you know, is it going to take a while for people to catch up in terms of all the processes you have in place?
Yeah. I remember there's one pro gamer who's like, you know, I can talk about this technology because by the time they catch up with this technology, I'll have tons of other new stuff. And I feel the same way. Our team, it's a small team, but we are just we're discovering new things every day. It's like so fun. It's just like a fascinating experience. And yeah, I think it's one of those things where it'll be easier to snowball ahead of time. And the incumbents are just like, they just don't care. A lot of them hate AI. It's like this shocking thing. It's this crown in the gutter that's been lying around for so long. Just been like, no one's been doing this. It's been feasible probably for like upwards of at least 2 years at this point. And it hasn't quite come together for anyone else. And I think that we can just take the entire cake. I think it'll be massive for us.
Okay. So, I mean, we're talking like 0-1 scenario. You're pretty optimistic about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like, just as an experience, it's amazing. And maybe that's clouding my judgment. That's like totally fair. But it is a different experience than like any other startup that I've worked on.
Well, I mean, so, okay. I mean, that sounds really good. One thing that, it is a for-profit, it is a business, and, businesses do great things. Obviously, I'm not. How is this going to transform the public sector? How is it going to transform the public in terms of what they know in terms of investigative journalism? Like, what are you already seeing?
So, what we're seeing, there's already been a few changes. The biggest change is that, they announced an update to this after, I don't know how much of this was already planned, but after our request for comment, they announced this update to this refugee grant program that essentially excluded the previous round of recipients from further participation in the program. So these religious NGOs like Church World Service, like USCCB, like Episcopal Migration Ministries, they're no longer able to receive the ORRPC grants. Maybe that's something that they already had in motion. I don't know for sure, but that was something that really kind of like made my day. I think that at a broader level, what's going to happen is that the fruits of all of these transparency laws will actually come to pass. And I think that you may begin to see more and more people turn against the concept of transparency altogether. And that kind of sounds like a crazy thing to say. It kind of sounds crazy. It's sort of this platitude at the moment. But I think you'll see very concrete ways, first in which, politicians will go about trying to repeal transparency laws without hoping anyone will notice, and maybe kind of, using covert language to hide that up. And then later on, more explicitly come out against transparency as a concept. And I think that's because, there was this quote from Colbert a while ago of like, his claim was that reality has a left-wing bias. And I think the like accurate version of that is that like sources reporting has a left-wing bias, right? The New York Times actually just does a better job than the New York Post or the Wall Street Journal or whoever at sources reporting. And there's all sorts of systematic reasons for that. But in the equivalent to that is that data reporting, transparency reporting has a natural like right wing or libertarian bias, right? Where every the more you look at the government, the more like the normal person thinks, hold on, it's doing what now? What is going on here? It's just this crazy thing that people don't know about, and the more they know about it, the more it becomes a problem for those governments and those programs specifically.
Yeah, in terms of transparency, I was thinking actually, Cambridge, the education department took down its listings of the faculty pages because they don't want people investigating. Obviously, there's the Wayback Machine. There's anyone with trivial technological know-how could get around this, but I guess they didn't think about that. Just makes them look like fools. But, there are a lot of institutions that have a lot of things that they want to hide that they don't want the public to know. And so this will probably trigger some sort of scramble, some sort of reaction. So we'll get to see when the water recedes, who's ready and who's not, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we can already see that. And there's this like Pareto frontier where there are ways where it's technically legal to hide it, but there are other kind of like countermeasures, like other disclosures that allow us to break through. And here's a very good example. We did this story on the 19th century family fortunes that are funding degrowth in Europe. So there are all of these heirs, like literal like great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren of people who invented like pharma fortunes in the 1800s, who are now funding degrowth. And they actually hid their money in these Swiss bank accounts, this organization called Swiss Philanthropy Foundation, which is essentially a money mixer. They host 106 different nonprofits. You donate to any of the nonprofits, it just registers on the disclosures as a donation to Swiss Philanthropy Fund. But we were able to use those records to trace back all of the donors, and the donors have the donor-level disclosures. So this degrowth organization, P4NE, they didn't disclose the donor amounts at all. So they didn't disclose, you know, how much they got from each donor, and they kind of hid it through the Swiss Philanthropy Foundation. But in a lot of cases, the donors themselves had to disclose that information. So we were able to cross-reference that and retrieve a lot of the transactions. Actually, not entirely all of them, interestingly, because some of the donors had different, you know, tax structures and things like that, and they didn't have to do the same filings. But we were able to retrieve the donor-end filings and use those to prove out all of the transactions to this degrowth NGO.
All right. So obviously there's a lot of things that you could do. I'm kind of curious, like, how much are you going to focus on America and how much are you going to focus on other countries?
So obviously I'm American. I, you know, care a lot about America. We've had some stories about other countries so far, other countries in the West. That's a good question. I mean, I don't have, I obviously have a bias. I mean, like, I'm American. I follow American news. Most of my friends are American. Like, I live here, so it personally affects me. But really, it is whatever news is fit to print. If we see a big story like we saw with, you know, the European family fortune story or with the UK censorship story, we'll absolutely cover that. So it is just depends on, you know, what we find and whether that's newsworthy.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me, what else would you actually like? What else would you like the public? I mean, this is brand new. It's been out for a week. Obviously, you're making the rounds and putting yourself out there. I mean, what do you want people to know about what you're trying to do here? Let's just be clear again. You are looking to raise for a seed round potentially, right? Potentially get investors. You're also looking to recruit. That's on the business side in terms of people that would put, you know, capital and labor into the company. What do you want the consumers out there? What do you want people out there to know about what your company wants to do?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of slop out there, and we are trying to do the opposite of slop. And we are trying to do the opposite of slop in a lot of ways. Number one is that all of the writing is human. So we do not use AI for writing. We purely, you know, we handwrite our articles and send them off in post notes. But no, we have people writing all of the articles. Number two is, of course, the sourcing. We don't say, you know, experts say. We don't make shit up. We don't, you know, go you know, making random like conspiracy theories. No, everything we say is proven by like literally like traceable financial documents that all of you guys read, or all of you guys can read. The second and another aspect of that is aesthetics. And I think a lot of people in like the new media space, even when they are actually breaking stories, they just like don't really put any effort into the aesthetics or into the design, or, you know, it's not purely kind of vanity thing. It's, you know, having good visual design actually communicates information better to the audience. And so you'll have things like the New York Post. And I bring up the New York Post not to especially shit on the New York Post, but because the New York Post actually breaks stories, right? New York Post actually has good sources reporting in some cases, but they also look like the fucking New York Post. And I think a lot of people in the space like don't understand that when you look like the New York Post, it just looks ugly. People will just not want to read this, even if there is a genuinely, you know, important and newsworthy scoop.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of trends in the new media space that I think people have begun to criticize, have begun to kind of grow bitter about. They see, you know, some of the conspiracy stuff, some of the schizo posting that happens. And like, I'm as guilty as anyone of complaining about it. But now I am actually trying to fix these things. I'm trying to not necessarily act with like contempt. I think there's been like a tendency of people to divide themselves into two camps with regards to Joe Rogan or like podcasters in general, which is either like you hate the podcasters and you have utter like dripping contempt for all of the podcasters, or you believe everything that's said on Joe Rogan. And I think that's not right. I think that there's a reason for the suspicion. And as we are proving out in official government documents and sourcing, there are genuine, not exactly conspiracies, but there are certainly like misuses of power and conflicts of interest and in some cases, literal crimes committed by government actors. And the solution to that is not just to, you know, shit on these people and not just to, you know, complain and gatekeep. It's kind of like trying to, you know, trying to centrally plan or trying to ban your way to innovation, right? No, you actually have to do something about it. And we are doing something about it. That's part of the mission. I think part of the mission as well is actually to change what is being discussed. Because a lot of these new media channels, they're still at the end of the day commenting on all of the same stories that are being broken by the New York Times or whatever. They're not breaking new stories. And I'm not saying that just to complain. I'm saying that to actually pilot out this system of breaking news stories and talking about those stories and having them, you know, go live with new media partners. Like we did our launch interview with MTS, for example, which is this new media company, more so tech media as opposed to, you know, political media, but still this like really interesting new media company that we partnered with for our launch. So if you yourself are, you know, a new media brand, a new media company, and you want to break some stories together, you know, let me know. Support at effort.news. And I think that there's this whole cascading wave, in part that we will ride, but in part that will also push forward, that's going to change the new media landscape a lot for the better.
All right, man. It was great talking to you. I'm excited. This is early times for your company. You know, early times for this field. And so hopefully we'll hear a lot of great things about it and we'll hear a lot of great things, you know, from it. I mean, great. Depends on how you define great. But, you know, that we learn how the world really is and make the appropriate decisions based on that, you know. So this is like a classic Silicon Valley story, right? For a better world. But for real this time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the unveiling is coming.
Yeah, awesome, man. Okay, Brian. So that's effort.news. Check it out online, everybody. I think, you know, by the time this posts, you know, there'll be more new things out there. So it's an accelerating field. And obviously if you're a funder or someone else like that, reach out, you know, I'll put all the links to Brian's info, in the show notes. All right, guys. Thank you.
Yeah.
This podcast for kids.